This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello and welcome to The Stand with Eamon Dunphy. Now, tomorrow, the world will commemorate, and the American nation in particular will commemorate 9/11. 9/11 was a terrorist attack. It's 20 years ago. Almost 3,000 Americans lost their lives, 2,753 at the World Trade Center, where two towers were struck by airlines. One, the North Tower, at 8:46 a.m. And the second was a United Airlines flight. It struck the Southern Tower at 9:03 a.m. The death toll was shocking, and the way those people died was shocking. For example, the people in the North Tower, the plane struck the Northern Tower between floors 93 and 99. Everyone above 93 died. And just to give some idea of the scale of this murderous attack, every single worker at Cantor Fitzgerald, which was an accountancy firm, all 658 people who went to work that day died. It's a moment and a day that few are who witnessed it will ever forget. The sheer scale of the carnage was unbelievable. Al-Qaeda was responsible. Osama bin Laden was the leader of the Al-Qaeda terrorism group. And what led to the war on terror, the so-called war on terror, waged by George W. Bush, assisted by Tony Blair, was always going to happen after this terrible day. And of course, all of that has led to the recent evacuation or abandonment of Afghanistan. Some people describe it as America fleeing. However, it is a moment that will strike particularly at people in the United States of America. And Niall Stanich, Associate Editor of The Hill, a very respected Washington newspaper, and White House columnist for The Hill, joins us now to discuss this particular commemoration 20 years on, and also significant developments in the fight against COVID, which we'll come to later on as a result of these developments, of a very, very stern speech President Joe Biden made to the American people last night. Niall, thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Tomorrow is a very poignant day for all Americans, I imagine. What is the mood now when Americans reflect on that day? Does it differ depending on politics? But I'm more interested in what we might call apolitical people's response.
I think there are a couple of different levels to the response. One of them is simply the visceral human response. And, you know, everybody remembers where they were when that happened. I was still living in Dublin, actually. I didn't come to the US until about 2 years later. But everyone remembers where they were. Everyone remembers the shock. For America, I mean, the sheer scale of the horror, which you described in your introduction there, Eamon, yes, is something that can never be forgotten. And I think for Americans in particular, the sheer astonishment and trauma that such a thing could happen out of the blue, as it were. I mean, of course, there's a historical backdrop that we could go into, but I mean, just in the sense that such a thing had previously been unimaginable,
yes,
traumatized the American people to an enormous degree. Now, from this distance, obviously, there is an evaluation of what subsequently happened in terms of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Their, you know, reactions do break to some extent, although along partisan lines, although not wholly so. But I think, right now, the reaction is rooted in that visceral human response, and also the fact that in some ways it seems maybe longer than 20 years ago. It seems almost a different world, and in other ways it seems a very short time ago, you know, because anyone who was an adult at the time can remember it so, so vividly.
Yes, and America had never suffered or endured terrorism inflicted from outside. There had been terrorists, one thinks of the Oklahoma bombings during the Clinton administration. There had been the odd incident of terrorism on this scale. When you reflect on it and when you talk to people about it, your colleagues in Washington, the enduring feeling of Americans, the legacy, if you like, obviously the war on terror, as you mentioned, the invasion of Iraq, the decision to go to Afghanistan to hunt Osama bin Laden down, all of these are measurable metrics that we can say this and this happened. But I wonder if the psyche of the American people, who had never had empire as such, if the psyche of American people and their relationship with the world changed as a result of this.
I think it did. I think there are a couple of elements to that as well. I think one is a degree of vulnerability that the American public had never really experienced before. I mean, America had obviously fought very bloody foreign wars.
Yes.
It had experienced Pearl Harbor.
Yes.
You had mentioned the Oklahoma City bombing. But what happened on 9/11 was of a different order. And I think that the idea that this group of Islamic fascists, really, I mean,
yes,
you know, fundamentalist is too mild a word, sitting in obscure parts of the world to most Americans, could orchestrate an attack on that scale was something that left Americans feeling very uncertain about their own security. I mean, it's worth noting, Eamon, and I remember even thinking this at the time, that a lot of people thought this was the kind of horrific beginning to an ongoing stream of attacks. I mean, people didn't necessarily think, well, that's what's happened on 9/11 and that's it. There was genuine fear of more attacks. There was, you will remember, sort of scares about anthrax and chemical attacks and things of that nature as well. So it alarmed, I think, Americans enormously. The other element of it is that it did, naturally enough in ways, breed, a desire to strike back. And I mean, that's a human desire. You know, there's no country that could undergo such an attack and not feel that desire to strike back.
Yes.
The problem, I think, was that bled quite easily into a sort of a xenophobic or kind of cowboyish unilateralism, which was quite ill-suited to addressing the complicated conditions that had given rise to September 11.
Yes, and the neocons, Dick Cheney, one springs to mind, but many others too. had already been agitating for America to make the 21st century America's century, and to go out into the world and dominate. That instinct of those people was fed. And of course, George W. Bush had never really was the author of much of this, was he?
No, that's right. I mean, there was a longer term project there where the neocons were sort of kicking back against this idea, which had taken root after the end of the Cold War, that we were entering a sort of a non-ideological, smooth period. I mean, the famous phrase from a historian called Francis Fukuyama was the end of history, the idea that the great ideological battles were behind us. Now, to be, as it were, fair to the neocons, September 11th proved that to be completely untrue, that there were still, in fact, these great battles between completely different visions of how the world should be, and that those battles could have, could manifest themselves in horrific and murderous fashion. But your point, I think, is well made, that the neocons had also been agitating, particularly in relation to Saddam Hussein, then the rather despotic leader of Iraq, to depose him. And of course, that wasn't directly linked to September 11th, but was used as the, September 11th was used as the premise for the invasion of Iraq.
And tomorrow, clearly there will be ceremonies, and clearly people will recall in a very melancholy way, as you said before, the visceral feelings that this attack aroused. And I have to say, I was working on that afternoon on a radio program, a drive time program, and we covered it, and it was unforgettable. We spoke with Conor Cleary, who was the U.S. correspondent of the Irish Times, who was on the balcony of his apartment, and he could see these towers coming down. It was an unbelievably emotional day for every human being, because the scale of it was so inhuman. I quoted that number of Cantor Fitzgerald employees, 658 people who died. But then there were these terrible, the courage of the firefighters and medical people was immense, and yet one saw and subsequently read of shocking stories of husbands or wives ringing their partners, their children, and saying, look, goodbye. They were trapped in this, high up in these towers, with no way out.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there were so many of those stories, and absolutely heartrending stories of exactly that happening. People knowing they were about to die and calling people who they loved to tell them that they loved them. Yes. And, you know, it's, and I remember that also in the other two manifestations of those attacks, which took place outside New York, one in the Pentagon, but the other one being the flight that went down near Shanksville, Pennsylvania, where people realized on the plane that they were doomed, that plane had been hijacked. And there were similar calls made from there. The firefighters that you mentioned going into the World Trade Center, knowing that they were fairly likely not to come out again. An astonishing display of bravery, and very moving. And, you know, you mentioned Conor O'Cleary there, who I know a little bit, not as well as you do, I think, but I know he was understandably very affected. I think Conor saw some of the people who jumped from the World Trade Center towers doing so. And, I mean, what can you even say about that? That's just a horrific thing to witness.
And it undoubtedly shaped American policy for a long period of time, and just may be, you know, in Biden's mind when he, you know, he's made a terrible mess of the withdrawal from Afghanistan, but he's a long time believer that America should not be fighting these forever wars, as they're called. And Afghanistan was called, I think it may have been Trump who first coined the phrase, a forever war.
I mean, I think Biden's objection to Afghanistan was, I think, the idea that basically the American military were boxing political leaders in over time, and that once Osama bin Laden had been killed, albeit in neighboring Pakistan, that the rationale for the U.S. forces staying in Afghanistan was very difficult to explain. I know you're not saying otherwise, but I mean, in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, Biden, like almost all American politicians, was in favor of certainly going into Afghanistan, and would have been supportive, at least in the very early stages, of giving George W. Bush the authorization to go into Iraq, although Biden, I think, became quite critical of the execution of that war quite soon after.
Yes, and as vice president, as Obama's vice president, he argued very strongly that once bin Laden had been, you know, taken care of, the rationale for staying was slim. And just a final question before we move on, Niall. Barack Obama's decision, I think it was in 2010-11, to send another 30,000 troops to Afghanistan, which would take them deeper into the mire of that particular territory. And Obama, too, there's an irony here. He had indicated that he was against the invasion of Iraq, something that enraged Bill Clinton, because when it came to a vote, I think Obama voted with the other senators. But can you clear that up for us?
So Obama, the Iraq war in particular, was a pivotal issue in the 2008 primary, when, of course, Barack Obama defeated Hillary Clinton. Obama, as a rather, frankly, obscure Illinois politician in the very early stages of his career, had criticized the war in Iraq before it began and had supported the war in Afghanistan. He had famously said that he's not opposed to all wars. He's opposed to what he termed dumb wars, which yes, was how he characterized the war in Iraq. The fact that Obama was only elected to the Senate in 2004 meant that he wasn't there for the vote that authorized the actual invasion. But it's interesting just how the political landscape changes. In the 2008 Democratic primary, the war in Iraq was a massive issue. And Hillary Clinton, who had been a senator and had voted for it, was dogged by that vote.
Yes.
And Obama very effectively used his opposition to the Iraq war to say it doesn't really matter that Hillary Clinton is so much more experienced than me. Sometimes experience, quote unquote, leads to a kind of coziness with the consensus, and the consensus can be wrong. And it was a very effective line of attack that Obama used against Hillary Clinton.
Indeed. And it launched his successful political career in terms of where he ended up. I just remember, smiling while I say this, when it was put to Bill Clinton around the time that Clinton and Obama were fighting for nomination, Clinton lost his cool and he said, "Give me a break." It was a funny moment because he knew the fact, the facts, but sometimes the facts can't get in the way of a good tale. And of course, the election of Barack Obama seemed like a good tale at the time. And just to move on to the COVID crisis, in a piece you wrote for The Hill, a really, really good piece, you described Biden's demeanor last night when he spoke about COVID and vaccine resistors and the resistance of so many Americans to taking the vaccine. He didn't beat about the bush, and it may well mark a turning point, you think?
Yeah, I think that's right, because it was a very noticeable shift in tone. Up until now, President Biden has really sought to sort of nudge along people who were reluctant to get vaccinated or to understand their concerns. That pretty much vanished last night, Thursday, in that he was much more overtly critical of people who refuse to get vaccinated. There are, in the United States, Eamon, about 80 million people who are eligible for vaccination and have not got any shot at all. And that obviously is prolonging the pandemic to a frankly needless degree. So Biden was very critical of those people, both in terms of his tone and in terms of the substance. Don't need to get into too many of the complexities of what he announced yesterday, but the chief change will be an attempt to mandate any company with 100 or more employees that either those employees must get vaccinated or they must undergo weekly COVID tests if they insist upon not getting vaccinated. That's a very, very significant shift and was matched by the president's rhetoric.
Yes, and you said in your piece that you felt that he had reestablished some authority and maybe in the slightly longer term would have regained some of the credibility that there's no doubt from the polling that the withdrawal from Afghanistan has robbed him of, really. The polls have turned bad for him, haven't they?
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. And you're right in ascribing that to the withdrawal from Afghanistan. The Afghanistan chaos was really an inflection point, bringing to an end the honeymoon period to the extent that Biden really ever had one. I mean, the polls fell quite precipitously. The poll ratings on Afghanistan specifically were terrible. But it also, that period also saw an erosion in his general approval rating. And I think that was driven by Afghanistan. But also the Delta variant clearly is surging here. That has knock-on effects in terms of not just life and death matters, but the economy, schools. Obviously, the academic year has just begun and parents are facing a disruption if children or teachers get infected with COVID. So all of those things, I think, had combined to create a bit of a sense that the Biden presidency was starting to look dangerously adrift or reacting to events rather than driving events. That's traditionally almost always a terrible thing in politics. You tend to get punished by voters for that. And therefore, I thought that the very assertive Biden speech on Thursday about COVID may have, as you say, reestablished some level of leadership or some measure of authority for him.
Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Now, the question of the Senate, Congress, hesitancy, if you like, to sanction Biden's spending plans. I saw somewhere that Janet Yellen, who is the Treasury Secretary, said America will run out of money soon. Is there a major problem there?
There is, because that is the so-called debt ceiling. And to try to explain that in simple terms, the United States government can't just overspend and overspend endlessly without congressional authority to do so. I mean, I don't know what the national debt is now. It's something huge, but it needs to be, that ceiling needs to be raised by Congress every so often. So Yellen's fear is that Republicans will refuse to do that. And I think the remarks that you're referring to, Eamon, she was saying that it'll run out of money a bit sooner than they previously thought. I think November had been the previous projection, and now it has moved up to October. And Yellen is understandably concerned about that. If the debt ceiling is not raised, just to be clear that this isn't some arcane subject, if it's not raised, the logical progression of that would be that the United States would default on its debts. If that were to happen, the tremors that would be sent through the global financial system would be huge. And so it is a thing that would have a serious impact on people in Ireland or the UK or anywhere else if that were to happen. So that's what she's worried about. Anyway, go ahead.
One gets the feeling that there's a febrile atmosphere in the United States overall, in Washington in particular, and that it's almost becoming ungovernable by this administration, and that there are in what is the most powerful democracy in the world, that there is a real existential crisis in the political system and amongst the population that to which there are no easy answers.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you were saying ungovernable by this administration. I don't know if it's governable by any administration at this point, given the splits or the element of not just polarization, but intolerance, really. The United States has obviously always been a diverse country ideologically as well as in many other ways. It has always been a rambunctious country. There have been very angry political debates, but it has managed thus far to hold together. Of course, been most endangered in that respect during the Civil War, but with that exception, hold together to some degree. I do think it's increasingly the case that right-wing Republicans and left-wing Democrats appear to inhabit completely different countries, completely different existences. I mean, what, let's say, Ted Cruz has in common with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Bernie Sanders, I don't know. I mean, they have completely different views of the world. And furthermore, you do have a political and media system, honestly, that rewards talking to the most hardline people on your own side. That's how you raise money. That's how you get on cable TV. That's how you get a big social media following. Yeah. And the dangers of the schisms deepening and becoming impossible to bridge, I think, is a very real danger, and I think people are quite right to be worried about it.
Now, last week, Niall, you alerted us to a measure that had been passed in Texas to do with abortion. It has become a big story now in the US, and indeed it's cutting through to Europe. This Texas law is absolutely savage. in terms of women's right to choose. It is, I think now, am I wrong or right in believing that it's become a national conversation now, and that it, if you give us the full details of this piece of legislation that's passing.
Sure.
I mean, in terms of people, for example, if you assist somebody in a taxi driver could be fined 10,000 plus costs, even unwittingly contributing to somebody going outside of the state to seek an abortion.
Yes, it's really an astonishing state of affairs and one that is very much part of the national conversation. The historic backdrop is that in the United States, a woman's right to abort a pregnancy up until the point that that fetus becomes viable is enshrined in the Constitution by the Roe v. Wade decision, which was back in 1973. And that established that as a constitutional right. The Texas law says that it basically bans abortion at any time beyond 6 weeks of pregnancy. That is a point at which many women do not even know they're pregnant. For other women, it could be 1 or 2 weeks after they first miss a period.
Yes.
There is no exception for cases of rape or incest.
Yes.
And the law essentially delegates to private citizens the ability to sue anyone who aids or abets an abortion. Now, you can't sue the woman herself who has the abortion, but you can sue basically anybody else. You alluded to the taxi driver example. That is literally the case. If a taxi driver takes a woman to an abortion clinic and that woman is more than 6 weeks pregnant, that taxi driver could be sued by another citizen for aiding and abetting an abortion, and would face a $10,000 fine, and could be sued by any number of private citizens. You don't need to be in some way personally involved in the case. So that opens up quite an extraordinary vista. I mean, you could have, for example, embittered ex-boyfriends or ex-partners suing everyone surrounding an ex-partner's abortion. You could have people mounting cases that they have no personal connection to whatsoever. And this has caused a massive rumpus, as you can imagine. Now, just yesterday, the Department of Justice, led by Merrick Garland, a man who President Obama had nominated unsuccessfully to the Supreme Court during his final year of the presidency, Merrick Garland announced that the Department of Justice is going to sue Texas over this law, because Garland's argument is that Texas is depriving women of a right that the Constitution enshrines, which, you know, you can't do.
Yep.
But in the meantime, the law stands because the Supreme Court has declined to intervene, and that's the situation that we're in.
Now, just two final questions. Gavin Newsom, the Democratic governor of California, is facing a recall election. If, as you told us last week, if he doesn't get 50% plus one, he's out. And whoever comes second, even if on 23%, becomes governor of California.
Mad system, but yes, you've described it accurately, yes.
Yeah, and the man who looks like he might come second is a black right-wing shock jock. I wonder how that race is faring, because I note that Elizabeth Warren, for example, and other Democrats are now showing up in California to try and prevent Newsom losing the governorship. Is there any polling? What's the story?
It's all hands on deck for Democrats to try to keep Newsom in. The polling suggests that he is developing a bit of a cushion against being recalled, which is a fancy way of saying being pushed out of office by a petition. But it's by no means a sure thing. What Democrats are worried about is turnout, because as is so often the case in politics, if you really hate Newsom, you may be much more likely to turn out to try to recall him than somebody who thinks he's okay. The person you're referring to, the highest ranking of the challengers, a guy called Larry Elder, who has all sorts of rather bizarre views, climate change denier, very frankly Neanderthal views on gender, all of that stuff. So if Newsom came in with 49%, he's out. And if Elder was next placed with, as you say, 20 or 25%, he's in. Democrats are, as I say, pulling out all the stops to try to avoid that, including Vice President Kamala Harris was back in her native California campaigning with Newsom.
Yes.
And we haven't got confirmation of this, but I believe President Biden is to make some kind of appearance there sometime in the coming days.
When will this particular exercise in democracy be decided? When do they get to vote?
Election day is Tuesday. If it's a clear verdict, then the result we know on fairly soon. But it's such a massive state, and there's all sorts of different provisions for voting by mail and all of that. It could take a while, particularly if it's a close result. But it'll be certainly one to watch. I believe, incidentally, that California, if it was its own nation, is something like the fifth largest economy in the world. So, I mean, it's extraordinarily large and important state. So we shall see what happens.
Yeah, and Arnold Schwarzenegger occupied the governor's mansion there for quite some time. Final question about Donald Trump. Did I see somewhere that he's 99.9% sure that he wants to run in 2024?
You may well have seen that. I think one of his aides was saying something to that effect. He has announced a couple of rallies coming up in the coming weeks, one in Iowa and one in Georgia. He has a massive war chest, over $100 million. And, of course, he's issuing his email statements, no longer being on Twitter or Facebook. He's lambasting Joe Biden via email. There is one thing that we should mention about Mr. Trump, and it links back, albeit in rather lurid terms, to where we started. As you pointed out, 20th anniversary of September 11th, President Biden will be attending events at all of the sites there. Obviously, it's a very somber day. Donald Trump will be marking the anniversary by offering color commentary on a boxing match in Florida, where Evander Holyfield is making a comeback at the age of 58. And Trump has been recruited to give ringside commentary there. So whether that is an appropriate thing for the President of the United States to be doing on the anniversary of September 11th, I will leave for your listeners to decide.
So would I. A bit of levity is no harm, even in the grimmest of situations. That's really, that's a good place to end, Niall. So thank you very much for joining us from Washington today. We're grateful to Niall Stanage, to all of you who listened, and, of course, particularly grateful to our sponsors, Tesco. That's all we have time for now. We'll talk to you soon.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.